Of all the memoirs I've read, I feel the most connected to Glennon Doyle and her style of writing, and specifically this book, Love Warrior. Like, I've thought a lot about the different stories that I want to write. I've thought a lot about the beginning, which I've mentioned to you guys lots of times. But because of this book, I was writing my notes and I was just like, okay, what am I going to write about? What is my message? And the thing that allowed me, or that kind of inspired me because of this book, was the structure. That was the big piece of it that I have not really been, that I have not really thought about up until this point. So that is going to be the first thing that I get into. It's going to be a big chunk of what I talk about today, structure. But before I get into it, I do want to talk a little bit about Glennon Doyle, because she's so freaking awesome. So I first heard about Glennon Doyle, or I first heard of her, on Elizabeth Gilbert's podcast called Magic Lessons. So I heard this podcast episode with Glennon Doyle back in 2016, in September of 2016. And I believe it was the last episode ever of Magic Lessons. I found it yesterday and I was like, oh, let me just listen to this again. And it was so weird. I don't know if you guys I'm sure you have this experience where you can remember where you were when you watched something or you heard something or you read something. So I remember the first time I listened to a fiction book on Audible was also 2016. And I remember I was going to a gym a lot, and I remember being on a specific treadmill at a window, and I would look out onto this courtyard, and I was just staring at the courtyard as I listened to this book. So every time I think of this one book that I read, I always think of that courtyard. So it's similar with this podcast episode that I listened to. I remember very vividly that I was living in Long Beach, California, in my tiny little adorable studio apartment. And I just remember listening to Glennon Doyle and being like, who is this woman? She was so, her energy is so contagious. I was so moved by her, and that has never changed. She continues to inspire me and motivate me. Now, for some reason during this time, I don't know why, she talked about this book, Love Warrior, back then, 2016. And I did not think oh, now I'm going to go read that book because I love this woman now. No, I didn't do that, because I was in a weird place where all I wanted to do was read self-help books. This was my turning point. And so I was reading about intuitive eating, and I was reading about another book about your health and your relationship with food. And I was reading Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. So anyway, I just never picked up any of Glennon Doyle's writing, even though I thought she was amazing. So then fast forward to, I guess, last year, I read Untamed, which is her most recent memoir, and I loved it. Then I was like, well, this is her most recent one. So I felt like I couldn't go back in time, because I felt like I knew what the book was going to be, but I did not. I did not know what this book was going to be, and I had no idea how it was going to end, even though I thought I did, because I know that she was married to someone and she had 3 kids with her husband. And then I knew that they got divorced, and I knew that he had cheated on her. And I knew all this through things that she had spoken publicly about. And in the book Untamed, which I read in the very beginning, in the beginning pages, she says, I was feeling the rage of a writer with a broken plot. Hell hath no fury like a memoirist whose husband just fucked up her story. Which is such a great line. So then when I started reading Love Warrior, I thought, okay, this book is going to be about her and her husband, surviving. But then he cheats on her, and then it ruins the marriage, or something like that. I knew very little about it. And so then I was very surprised, because in the book, that is what happens. He does cheat on her, but she's writing about it. So it's not I thought it was she published the book and then she found out that he cheated on her. But actually in the book, she finds out that he cheats on her. And then I thought they were going to break up, and then she was going to meet Abby Wambach, the professional soccer player, and because I know that she's with Abby now. So I thought that that's how this was going to end. But this is way before she met Abby. And so it actually ends with her. And sorry, if I'm giving anything away, then you might not want to listen, but I feel like this book is old enough that I can talk about this. In the book, she actually stays with her husband. I mean, she separates from him, and then they find their way back together. But anyway, I'm a big fan of Glennon Doyle. She is one of those kinds of writers where I read her words and I see myself in what she's written, even though she has a very different experience from me. But I see myself in the way she is being so raw, the way she is telling her truth. And I'm very drawn to that because I want to be like that too. Okay, let's get into it. We're going to talk about structure. So let me go through the structure of her book as best I can. So in the very beginning, there's a prelude. It opens on her wedding day and she is getting married to her husband, Craig. Here's something that she writes in the prelude. My dress is too tight around my waist and I'm wearing fake eyelashes, a rhinestone tiara, and heels like stilts. I am more costumed than I am dressed. But this is what a bride is supposed to look like. And since the day I decided to become sober and a mother, I've been trying to become who I'm supposed to be. So there's a lot packed into that sentence or that those few lines. It's her wedding day. She's getting married. She's sober and she's pregnant. And she's trying to be a good person, basically. And so she's hopeful, but there is definitely like a sadness to this. So that's the prelude. Next, the book is divided into three parts. Part one, part two, and part three. And there's no names for the parts, but I have gone ahead and named them to help me understand, like, okay, what was each part about? So part one, I call the before image. And for Glennon, this is from childhood to getting pregnant. And then it brings us back to that prelude where she's marrying her husband and it finishes the rest of the wedding day. So it's like not the very end of the prelude. It comes to the beginning and then finishes that story of her on her wedding day. My prelude, I'm kind of wedded to the idea of doing this rock bottom. Her rock bottom is not her wedding day. She does hit rock bottom during part one in this before image, but she doesn't start the book there. It starts with this like uncertain moment and it ends with her trying to make the right decision. So it feels like this prelude for her is an inflection point for something, but it's not the rock bottom. So anyway, that is part one. It's this before image. We go from childhood all the way up to marrying her husband, being pregnant, and just trying to like be a better person. Part two, I have named the explosion. This is where we're going through pregnancy and marriage and then three kids. So they end up having three kids together and it's all hard. Then there is a section about writing. Okay. This is where she starts to have this glimmer of hope and light and purpose in her life. Then we get into Craig's addiction to porn and then he starts going to therapy and then the real bomb is dropped, which is why I'm calling it the explosion. She finds out that Craig is cheating on her. By the end of part two, she makes a plan to move through this situation and find herself. So at the end of part two, you feel like there's hope. There's hope. We don't know what the path is or what the route is to get there, but we know that she's like, I am going to do this. I can do this. And then part three, I have named the transformation. And this is where she starts going to therapy. There's a lot of personal growth here. She learns how to breathe. Like she goes to a breathing class. There is forgiveness. There is self-trust. It's a new way of being. And then there's an afterword and it closes with her and Greg exchanging their new vows. So when I first read this, I was like, I love this. It's very much bookends to the story. We start the prelude on their wedding day and then we do the afterword with this renewal or this exchanging of new vows. The more I sat with it, the more I felt like it was too wrapped up in a bow. It was hopeful about the future. And for myself, I think I'd rather end with more of a punch as opposed to like, and now things are great. Even though she doesn't say things are great, but like there's a lot of hope in her afterword. Okay, so what could my book look like if I followed this structure? So I'm not doing it exactly like her, but I really like, I cannot tell you guys, like I was just like staring into space after I like figured out her structure. And this is the first time I was like, okay, what could mine be? And now I really feel like I have it. So I'm so fucking excited. Okay. So my prelude, as I said, I still think that I want to keep my prelude with the rock bottom moment with me at the bar, cocaine, lots of drinking, a really bad relationship with food and my body, somewhere around getting dumped and partying, like it, just a dark place. So my before would be from, we got to go back to childhood and it would be until the moment that, for me, this moment that everything changed. And for me, there is one moment that everything changed. And that was when I read The Untethered Soul, which I have told you guys about. So I'm not going to go back into it. But I knew when I read that book that I needed to change. And I knew that I couldn't keep living this way. And I wouldn't keep living this way. But I had no idea how I was going to. So it was a very, I don't know how to describe this moment. And I need to figure out how to describe it because I'm going to write about it. But like, it was thrilling and terrifying at the same time. So I've been thinking how for part one, this before, my part one and my part two is going to be before and after. That's it. There's no part three. Before and after. So part one brings me to this moment where I read The Untethered Soul and I decide, okay, this is the moment I'm going to change. And everything up until that point is kind of a spiral. I'm just going down, 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 down until I reach the bottom. And then after this moment is more like a snowball effect of me doing everything that's pulling me closer and closer toward my authentic self, which is where I am now. I'm still working towards that. So there's a lot that goes on here. I read a lot of books. I meet Sam. I move to Long Beach. I learn about intuitive eating. I move to North Carolina. I take the writing course, rite of passage. I get married. I have kids. And through this, after, there is a lot of one step forward, two steps back kind of stories. So it's not going to just be all like, oh, me like doing wonderful things to become a better person. It's going to be like me trying and failing a lot. And then the afterward, I really do like this idea of them being bookends in some way. So I think for my afterward, it will be in some ways the opposite of the prelude. So like no drinking, no drugs, enjoying food, being with Sam and my kids, and not so much escape from my life. It should be a scene. It should be a story. It should be funny. And it should highlight the continual struggle and the continual growth because I don't want to act like I have it all figured out now. Okay, so let me just quickly talk about her part one and the childhood, because this is really interesting. What I am learning about memoir in general is that they are comprised of many tiny little stories that combine to make one story, one larger message for the reader. When I'm thinking about my childhood, okay, I don't need to think about it like, okay, what was my childhood like? And like in this big kind of vast, overwhelming way. Glennon goes, page 4, I was 4 years old and my father is a football coach at our neighborhood high school. And so that's how she starts page 11. And this is like one thing in childhood. And then she tells a story of one of her earliest memories because she's 4. And she talks about how beautiful her mother was, how people always commented on how she was beautiful too. And this story is like 3 pages long. It's short. It's all short, little tiny stories. At the end of the story, she writes, years later, when I become less beautiful, when I no longer have regal ringlets to pat or perfect skin to admire, when I'm no longer small and simple and precious, I wonder how I'll ever be worthy of offering or receiving love. So she tells the story of when she's a little girl, and then she also tells the negative effects of that moment that will have a huge impact on her life. It's like, okay, what stories from my childhood show my understanding of my self-worth, show what I needed to do to be loved? What are the stories that you can see me being pulled away from my authentic self? Or maybe we see me being being my authentic self and then being pulled away. So then on the next story for her, now we're on page 14, she writes, I'm 10 years old and trying to disappear in the corner of the velour couch in my grandmother's living room. So she went from a story at 4 years old to a story at 10 years old. And the question that it seems to be is like, what will this story be and what impact will it have on her life? And again, this is another story, three and a half pages long. And this story is the first time she throws up after eating and she's only 10 years old, which, you know, this is obviously a really pivotal thing that happened for her, a big moment. So when I'm thinking about the stories from my childhood, it's like, okay, what stories had a greater impact on the rest of my life? Okay, these are tiny little moments that I can write about. And the reason I wanted to share that is because I feel like this is so doable. Like when you think about like writing about your childhood, it feels too big. But when I think about writing about tiny little stories that had an impact, I'm like, I can do that. I can totally do that. Okay, the next thing that I want to talk about is coined terms. You guys remember we talked about coined terms in Green Lights? Matthew McConaughey coined the term green lights, and he talks about it all throughout the book. So in Love Warrior, Glennon coins a term, and I'm going to introduce, she introduces it on page 19. So I'm going to read this to you. "So every morning before I walk into high school, I tell myself, just hold your breath till you get home. I throw back my shoulders, smile, and walk into the hallway like a superhero in a cape. To onlookers, it appears that I've finally found myself. I haven't, of course. What I found is a representative of me who's just tough and trendy enough to survive high school. The magic of sending my representative is that the real me cannot be hurt. She is safe inside. So, as someone else, I have finally arrived." So her term is her representative. It's kind of like the Instagram version of yourself, the person who is acting like everything's okay. If she just wrote it here, I don't think this would have really like resonated with me as much. But the way that she keeps coming back to it throughout the book, it just really, and we talked about this with in Green Lights too, not with his coined term, although it works with that too. But there was something else in Green Lights that he kept coming back to. This idea of less impressed, more involved. So it's the same kind of idea. When you really want to let your reader know about something, you just keep coming back to it. So then, okay, now it's homecoming week for high school. She has just returned from the mental hospital. She went in because she was in a bad place, and she was bulimic, and she needed and wanted help. And so now she's back, and she's been nominated to homecoming court and voted leading leader of her senior class. So she's on a float for some parade for homecoming week. And she writes on page 30, "You have to be known to be loved, and none of these waving people knows me. They only know my representative. This is not a victory parade for me, but for her. She is the one waving. I am the one holding my breath again underneath. She is the star. I am the mental patient." Just really quickly, this reminded me of when I was a junior in college, I was at this like athletic banquet. I got this award for like, I forget the name of it. It was like female athlete of the year. There was a female and a male. It was like a really big deal. Like everybody in of all the sports, I was the female athlete. This was when I was at my tiniest weight, my unhealthiest that I've ever been. I was always in the weight room. I was always running. I was always working out. I was never getting stronger. I wasn't lifting weights. I was running. I was working on my abs. I was, I just wanted to be where I could be burning calories and not anywhere else. So the people who decided to give me this, you know, these are like my trainers and stuff. They're like, "Oh, Charlie's always working out. She's always in the weight room." And basically I was rewarded for withering down to nothing. It made me think of Glennon's story, because not only is this person that I'm putting out there a representative of myself, the person that I want everybody to think I am, now I'm being rewarded for it. And here she is up on this float, like, here I am. I'm the homecoming court leading leader. Like, this is what everybody wants. You're doing great. Okay, so then on page 111, this is where she has some light with writing, and she sees her friends post something on Facebook called a list called 25 things. So it's just like interesting facts that people are posting about themselves. And she starts writing, and then she writes, "I sit and stare at the words I've written. Stark, bold, and unapologetic. I feel thrilled. Yes, there I am, right there. That's not lost Glennon or found Mrs. Melton. That's not my representative. That's the real me. I want to learn more about me, so I keep writing." So again, now she is finding herself that's not the representative. So it's like this, instead of as before when we talked about the representative, she's like, "I need my representative out there. My representative protects me." And now she's like, "Oh wait, this is new. This is different. This feels good. And this is the real me that's not my representative." And then finally, on page 226, it's kind of like a revelation about our representatives. She writes, "If we choose to be perfect and admired, we must send our representatives out to live our lives. If we choose to be real and loved, we must send our true, tender selves. The irony is that our true selves are tougher than our representatives are." So she has this coined term throughout the book. And now at the end, she has this new understanding of it. And this new realization that, you know what? I thought that my representative was my armor, was my shield. And actually, it hasn't done that. And when I can be my authentic self, that's when I'm strong. Okay, this next thing, I like had a little bit of a meltdown reading this book. So you guys might recall that I have a title for my book, and it is Totally Fine Trainwreck. And she, in this book, talks a lot about being totally fine in the way that I mean, where I don't mean it at all. It's where we say we're totally fine when we actually mean we're not. We're not doing well at all. We are a mess. So let me share some of this with you. On page 21, a friend asks her what sex is like, because she's never had sex before and Glennon has. And she explains how much she doesn't like it. And then a few weeks later, her friend reports back to her and says this: "I don't know what you were talking about. It's the best thing in the world. It's totally amazing." I stopped talking about sex after that. I just pretend to my boyfriend and friends that it's all totally amazing. Sex, friendship, high school, being me. Yes, it's all totally amazing. So when I read that, I was like, yeah, this feels similar to the premise of my book. It's like she's pretending that everything is totally amazing, which for me is totally fine. And it's easier to pretend that you're okay than to admit that you're not. So I was excited when I read these words, but then I read this next part when she's at the mental hospital. On page 27, she writes, "One day a girl with a sliced up arm says, 'My mom sent me here because she says no one can believe a word I say.' I look at her and want to say, 'Does she see that you tell the truth on your arms? Like I tell the truth in the toilet?' By the time we landed in the hospital, most of our families considered us insensitive liars. But we didn't start out that way. We started out as ultra-sensitive truth tellers. We saw everyone around smiling and repeating, 'I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine.' And we found ourselves unable to join them in all the pretending. We had to tell the truth, which was, 'Actually, I'm not fine.'" And so now I'm reading these words and I'm like, okay, this is too similar to my idea. It's no longer my idea. It's Glennon's idea. She's already written the book I want to write. And I'm like kind of freaking out. Like, I'm so excited that she's writing this. And then I'm like, oh no, like this is, she's already done it. So I'm in bed and I'm reading the book and I'm like, I close the book and Sam comes in the bedroom and I'm telling him, and he's just like, "It's not the same as yours." So I stop whining and I keep reading. And then on page 42, she writes, "A few days before Thanksgiving, I find out I'm pregnant. There is never a question about what we will do. Craig takes me to the clinic and we sit together silently, staring at old magazines, naked strangers again. Eventually, Craig looks at me sideways and whispers, 'You okay?' I nod, 'Yeah, totally, really, I'm fine.'" So now I'm like, okay, now she's like really saying totally and fine together. It's okay, I'm totally fine. Okay, on page 43, she writes, "I follow him inside and let him lead me to the couch, where he covers me with a blanket. We sit together for a few minutes, talking about other things. He tells me that his buddy is throwing a big party that night, but he's not going because he wants to stay with me. I wonder why he's mentioned this at all, but I don't ask. Instead, I say, 'You should go. I'm totally fine.' I expect him to ignore this ridiculous suggestion. Instead, he looks at me and says, 'Are you sure?' This is the wrong answer to the question today is asking of us. I feel my stomach clench, but I smile and send my representative forward to say, 'Totally, I'm fine. Go ahead, I'll call you tomorrow.'" So so here she is saying totally fine again. And this is getting to the essence of what I want to write. I want my book to be about the journey towards my authentic self. And in these next lines I'm going to read to you, Glennon says it better than I ever could. On page 131, she writes, "Pain splits us into two. When someone who is suffering says, 'I'm fine, I'm fine,' it is not because she is fine. It is because her inner self told her outer self to say the words, 'I am fine.'" Totally fine. Okay, so Glennon and I, we do not have the same stories. We do not have the same past. And we do not have the same voice. What we share is a similar belief. And I think that that's why I feel so connected to her. And I think that's a good thing. I am going to write my book about totally fine train wrecks. And rather than feel like I'm stealing her idea, I feel even more inspired and motivated because someone I admire has already expressed something that I feel deep inside my bones. Okay, so I have talked about how much I love Glennon, and I do love Glennon. Now, there were some moments that I read that there was something about it that I didn't like. And so I wanted to figure out what that was. And I'm going to try to articulate that here. So a few pages later, they are at Craig's therapist's office because Craig wants to tell her something. And he's about to tell her about how he's been cheating on her. And she writes, "I look at Craig and feel ice for him. Sharp ice. Icicles. I say, start talking. If you leave out anything, I will leave you and never come back. You know I'm capable of that. I stand up from the couch and walk across the office. I sit down in a chair as far from Craig as possible." This is her. It feels like she's putting Craig in his place. And this is the kind of response that I have always fantasized about in confrontations with people. Like, I want to say the strong thing, the angry thing, the thing that makes me the winner. But now when I read it, it doesn't feel good to put someone in their place. It feels like stooping to their level or being like self-righteous. Like, for me, it just doesn't feel good anymore. You have to tell the story of what happened, of course. And she is telling what happened. She's saying, she's quoting what she said. But the way that she's telling it, it feels like she feels indignant about it. And maybe she did at the time, but the way it's written, it almost feels like as the writer of the book, it feels like she still feels like this was the correct response or that she had a right to have this response. I don't know. If I were to write these lines, I think I would try to take myself out of the story first. So maybe I would delete the first part of, like, I feel ice for him, sharp ice, icicles. Like, I would probably just say, like, I look at Craig and say, and, like, you know, here are the facts. This is what I said. If I were to write about my ex, John, like, if I write about him, I want the reader to decide if they don't like him. I don't want to plant, like, he's a jerk and you guys should side with me. I'm reading The Glass Castle right now by Jeanette Walls. Her parents were horrible caregivers. Throughout most of the book, she recalls stories and she never writes anything disparaging about them. She writes what they said. She writes their actions, but she doesn't say like that, you know, they weren't good parents or that they didn't look out for her. Like, and the way that that's written, and I'm going to talk about this more when I do my deep dive on that book. It feels so good to be the one to decide like, oh my God, Jeanette, this is horrible. And I'm rooting for you. In these pages, in these lines, I felt like Glennon was trying to get us to take her side. And by doing that, I actually felt bad for Craig. And I know Craig is wrong. And she actually does throughout the book, like, make Craig look really good. And she talks about all of his great qualities too. It was just these lines that didn't sit well with me. And then here is one more thing. It's toward the end of the book. And her daughters are like dancing around and they talk about like being sexy. They're like dancing in a sexy way. They like learned this move from Beyonce or something. The younger sister is dancing and like doing the sexy move. And then the older sister says, sexy is inappropriate. And she says, right, mom? And so then Glennon says this, I freeze. This argument sounds very much like the civil war that has raged in my mind for the last 2 decades. Is sexy inappropriate? Is sexy wrong? Is sex wrong? It can't be wrong. But how can something that has forever been twisted to subjugate women not feel wrong? My girls stare at me waiting for the verdict. Delivering it feels above my pay grade. This moment feels heavy with meaning, as if my response might determine the kind of woman these girls become. So I love how she's talking about this in the moment and like the deepness of this question and how much pressure she feels. And so then I assume that she's not going to nail this response, but then she does. It feels like too perfect of an answer, too well-spoken. And also I think the thing that really made me feel like this doesn't feel true anymore is that she goes on for a really long time. It's like a very long monologue without much interruption from the girls. And so then I'm asking myself as I'm reading, like, is this really how it happened? Did you really say all of this so perfectly, so eloquently? It doesn't go with the way that I think of Glennon as being so raw and simple and clear. Like, it was just a little bit too polished. Now, this brings up the idea of taking creative liberties. I've talked before about taking creative liberties and like, I'll bring up Green Lights again, like how Matthew McConaughey is so great at like recalling stories and putting so much dialogue in there that you're like, there's no way he can remember all of this dialogue. So he's taking creative liberties and he's writing them in and he's making the story better. And so maybe Glenn was taking creative liberties here, or, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe she did say all of this and maybe her young daughters did just stand there and listen and were like totally hanging on to her every word. But in this case, I think that if you're going to take creative liberties, I don't think that she needed to. I don't think we needed it to be this polished answer. Okay, so let's talk about the afterword. And I mentioned at the top that the afterword is where they are exchanging their new vows. And I felt like it was too wrapped up in a bow. Let me just read the last lines. I do not know whether we will spend our lives married or loving each other from a distance, but I now know the path of the love warrior. I will not betray myself. I will trust the wisdom of the still small voice. I will not let fear drown her out. I will trust her and I will trust myself. Love, pain, life, I am not afraid. I was born to do this. I realized that the thing that this reminds me of is something that I have talked about in my rite of passage sessions. And I actually coined a term for this last cohort with one of my other writing friends. And what we came up with is it's a live, laugh, love moment. And I call it a live, laugh, love moment because it's like that signage, you know, that people have in their houses, like live, laugh, love, like so general, so cliche. It's cliche. And I want the ending to be unforgettable. So what I do with live, laugh, love moments in essays is there are three things you can try. You can just delete it and whatever was before the live, laugh, love moment, maybe that's your ending. Sometimes that works and that might be the easy fix. Sometimes you can call back to a previous anecdote. So like bring us back to a different story and come back to that. And then the final thing is to reinforce that you don't have it all figured out. So I think that that's what I am thinking about. Like, even though she's saying like she doesn't have it all figured out, she is kind of like, I am a love warrior now and I will not betray myself and I will trust her and I will trust myself, which is all great. But for me, it just reads a little bit boring. And it also feels like she's making this grand plan for the future. And I would rather be like, and I still don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Like that's kind of like where I want to go with my ending or not. I mean, I could be wrong. I'm not sure. The great thing about this is that even though like I had these certain things that didn't sit with me the right way, that I didn't love, it's because of those things that I was really able to figure out how I want to write my stuff. Because of this ending and because it made me think about this stuff, I really thought about my ending so much more now. And I haven't really been able to think about what I would do for my ending. And now I am like, I feel like I'm in a place where I might actually be able to start writing my book soon. Like it feels like it's going to happen soon. When I get to the end of the opening, I don't know if I've talked about this yet, but the end of the prelude. So the prelude is me, like you see me at my worst, I'm a total mess. And then at the very end of the prelude, I'm talking to a friend or somebody and she asks me, how are you? And I respond, I'm totally fine. And then that's it. That's the ending. And so then to come back at the ending and, you know, it's not that I am now actually totally fine and actually great, but the way I am in the prelude is so different, drastically different from the way that I am going to be at the end of my story, at the end of my book. And that's what I want to show in the mirroring. And I don't want it to be wrapped up in a bow. And I don't want it to seem like I have it all figured out. But there definitely is some kind of like satisfaction that I've come a long way.